At any rate, the man who will be moderating tonight's program is Dr. Richard Batten from MIT. And if there's anyone who is as well qualified to moderate tonight's program, it is he, because he has worked as closely with the Apollo Mission Development Program as just about anyone. You've read his biography here. There's really not much I can add to it, so I'll give you Dr. Batten.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here this evening. I really didn't know that I was going to be at the Harvard Law School Forum until my wife called me this afternoon. She said she heard that Dr. Von Braun was going to be here tonight, and I knew I was going to be introducing him. The name of Werner Von Braun and the exciting world of space exploration are inseparable, both in fact and in the minds of people everywhere. It is indeed a singular honor to be asked to introduce him to you this evening. His research in rocketry began 40 years ago when, at the age of 18, he enrolled at the Berlin Institute of Technology. There, with Professor Hermann Oberth, and later under the sponsorship of the German Society for Space Travel, he worked on a liquid-fueled rocket engine which developed a mere 15 pounds of thrust. In contrast, the Saturn rocket, which was also built under his direction and which first launched three men toward the moon, had a thrust of 7.5 million pounds of thrust. The close of World War II, Dr. Von Braun came to the United States, where under contract to the Army, he directed high-altitude firings of the V-2 rocket, which he and his colleagues had developed at the Rocket Center of Peenemünde during the war. In 1950, he and his group went to Huntsville, where he became chief of the Guided Missile Development Division of the Redstone Arsenal. The result of these first few years at Huntsville was the Redstone missile, which was not only the first large American guided ballistic missile system, but was also the vehicle which propelled the first American astronaut, Alan Shepard, into space. The Jupiter and Jupiter C were also developed at Huntsville. In fact, months before the famous day of October 4th, 1957, when Sputnik was placed in orbit, Dr. Von Braun had tried in vain for the go-ahead to launch the first artificial Earth satellite with the Jupiter missile. The United States was to be denied that historical first, as well as a number of others to follow. Indeed, during the several years after Sputnik, our space activities were confined merely to responding to the dramatic Russian lead. The fact that we were able to respond at all, and then rapidly to pull ahead to accomplish last year the greatest adventure of mankind, is due in large part to the single-minded purpose of Werner Von Braun. Dr. Von Braun is now Deputy Associate Administrator of NASA in charge of planning future U.S. space missions. He left the post of Director of the George C. Marshall Space Flight Center in Huntsville in March of this year to assume this new and important responsibility. As you might expect, the list of honors and awards which he has received is almost endless, and I will not take from his time to read them now. However, as a footnote, I will say that I had the pleasure of being present when just last week in Houston he was made an honorary fellow of the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics. Dr. Von Braun is a scientist and technician of great merit. What distinguishes him, however, is his vision and his leadership. Today, with a general pall and gloom settling in over the aerospace industry, this vision and leadership is more important to us than ever. We who are dedicated to the exploration of space look to him again to point the way. Dr. Von Braun?
Thank you, Dr. Batten. On that guest, ladies and gentlemen. The last 9 years will probably, for all time, be the most exciting years, not only in my own life, but in the lives of something like 100,000 people in the aerospace program of this country. It was in 1961 that President John F. Kennedy proposed to the American people in the Congress to tackle a difficult, long-range objective that would clearly set us ahead in the space game compared to our Soviet counterparts. he selected, as he put it himself, a difficult goal because he wanted to accomplish more than just a spectacular, like landing a man on the moon. He wanted to raise the eyes of the American public towards higher and more difficult objectives. He wanted, as he put it himself, establish new frontiers because he was convinced that in a closed society without frontiers, things were apt to go downhill. I think this is more important today than ever. We have to keep the frontiers open because only if we keep striving for things that so far have been unattainable will things continue to go ahead. It has always been like that in the history of mankind and will continue to be like that. We have spent approximately $23 billion on the Gemini and the Apollo program, which paved the way for Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin to step down on the moon in June 1969. There has been a great deal of talk about this tremendous sum of money and whether it would not have been wiser to use it here on Earth for our many other national problems. There was urban decay. There was a great ecology program. There was the pollution of our atmosphere and the rivers. The question arose, why didn't we spend it here? Well, let me assure you that every nickel, every penny of these $23 billion was spent here on Earth. It was not spent on the moon. It found its way through wages and salaries to grocery stores and to automobile dealers and to home builders and to nurseries and to hospitals and all the things we need. During these same 10 years in which our space program went all the way from Sputnik to a manned landing on the moon, our national economy expanded from a gross national product of $450 billion per year in 1961 to over $900 billion in 1969. It more than doubled in 9 years. I think this is no pure coincidence. It was really the stimulus to science and technology, the demand to attain the unattainable, to meet specifications, to acquire a degree of perfection in what we were doing that was unprecedented, that constituted our most important spin-off product. We can do things that we set out to do. Our big problem today is not, can we go to Mars, or can we fly an unmanned spacecraft to the outer planet, or can we establish a decent Earth resources management system on our home planet. The question is, what do we want to do? I can assure you science and technology is ready today to solve all these tasks. We just have to decide that we want to solve them and we can solve them. There's, however, one thing that I would like to say in this connection. After we landed on the moon, a lot of people and a lot of newspapers said, if we can land a man on the moon, why can't we clean up our rivers, clean up our atmosphere, do something about urban decay and so forth? I believe there's a difference. Many of these problems that I just quoted are fundamentally social problems. They are problems that do not require sophisticated technological solutions, but they require legislation. They require the willingness, for example, to pay the price for cleaning up our rivers, or to burn cleaner fuel, or to produce less automobile exhaust. These things will cost a certain price, not necessarily an exorbitant price. I'm sure it will be a price that we all are entirely willing to pay. But only through legislation is it possible to get there from here. The problem here with these problems is the conflict of human interests. If you ask me why we were so successful with Apollo, why could we do it on time and within the resources that were allotted to us, and why were there apparently very few difficulties? I think I have only one answer. There are no people between here and the moon that were in our way. We could chart our course here. We didn't step on anyone's toes. We didn't have to acquire any right-of-ways going to the moon. We had a charter cut out for us in NASA. There was no jurisdictional dispute with other government agencies, let alone with cities and states and port authorities and so forth. We could implement our program after we identified what we how we wanted to go about the task given to us. For the last 9 years, I worked for NASA as director of the George C. Marshall Space Flight Center, where, as Dr. Batten just pointed out, I was in charge of the development of the Saturn rockets for our Apollo moon landing program. In the spring of this year, Dr. Thomas Paine, our new NASA administrator, who unfortunately left us again half a month ago, asked me to come to Washington and take on the long-range planning function for NASA, with the idea in mind that the time now had come to chart a new course for our space objective. Where should we go from here now that we landed on the moon? And this is what I'd like to talk to you about today. So I apologize if I can't show you any slides on the moon here today. I'm sure you have seen them all in Life magazine. You're entirely familiar with them. I want to take you out to our objectives for the next 10 years. And you will find that we are not giving up our objectives in science and our objectives in exploration, but we are orienting a very major part of our space program to the here and now, to the problems right here on our home planet. And I hope when I'm through with my little talk, the big question that I know many of you have in your minds, how relevant is the space program to our present environment, to our problems right here on Earth, will have found the answer. If not, I will be glad to answer any further questions you have after I'm through with my slide presentation. Can I now have the first slide, please? Just to begin with where we ended Apollo, this is the Saturn V rocket that we used to fly the Apollo spacecraft to the moon. After we have flown four more flights of the standard Apollo configuration with the Saturn V rocket to the moon, we plan to fly the space station into a low Earth orbit that we call the Sky Lab. It will be flown on top of the first two stages of a Saturn V in lieu of the third stage, and they will occupy this space here. This portion here can be seen in a little more detail here. The lower portion is a large crew quarter space, total volume about comparable to a three-bedroom, one-family home. On top of this unit, which is actually a converted propellant tank from the Saturn V's third stage, there will be an airlock. And on top of the airlock will be a docking adapter, a kind of a space railroad station, at which arriving spacecraft can attach themselves so that people can transfer from the arriving spacecraft down into these crew quarters. And on top of the multiple docking adapter will be a thing that we call the Apollo Telescope Mount. It is actually a manned solar observatory for special observations of the sun. Next slide, please. This Skylab is scheduled to go up into Earth orbit in late 1972, after four more flights to the moon have been completed, the first of which is scheduled to take off on the 31st of January 1971. After the Skylab itself has been launched unmanned into a 250 nautical mile altitude orbit, it will be visited by three astronauts who will travel in the well-known command module that we used in the Apollo program, launched into the same orbit by a smaller Saturn 1B rocket. It will dock with the nose of this command module into one of these hatches of the multiple docking adapter, whereupon the crew members can transfer through a crawl tunnel into this orbital workshop, or into the crew quarters of the space station facility. Next slide. Now here you see what the unit will look like when operationally deployed. You see a few changes here. The first place, these big elephant ears sticking out of the sides of the crew quarters are solar cells which will generate a total of 5 kilowatts of electrical power by converting impinging solar energy directly into direct current, into electricity. This electricity will be used to run the fans and air conditioners and pumps and the life support system, the transmitters and so forth for the Skylab itself, for all the equipment that is inside these living spaces, the crew quarters. The Apollo telescope mount, as you can see here, has been swung around from this position into this position, and four solar cells have been folded out to form this windmill-shaped array of solar cells, likewise pointed at the sun, which will provide all the electrical power necessary for the electrical instrumentation in the solar observatory. Here you see the command and service module that has arrived and brought the first three astronauts docked to the multiple docking adapter. Note that there's another point where they could dock, namely here. Let me say in this connection that you may have read in the papers that we presently have a delegation in Moscow to talk to the Soviets about the possibility of visiting Soviet spacecraft by American spacecraft and vice versa. What we are talking there, what we are discussing with the Soviets really, is the problem of this interface. What kind of a connection must a Soviet craft that wants to visit us here, for instance, provide so that Soviet cosmonauts can re-dock, latch onto this point and transfer into our vehicle? Now, the mechanical part of that problem is relatively straightforward. There's no question that they could cut a hole into their spacecraft and provide such a mechanical docking hatch. The difficulties lie in other matters that are not so obvious. For instance, they pressurize their spacecraft with 15 psi, full atmospheric sea level pressure, and fill them with air, in other words, nitrogen-oxygen mixture. Our spacecraft are pressurized only to one-third of atmospheric pressure, namely 5 psi, and we work with pure oxygen. And of course, when an astronaut wants to transfer from one vehicle to another, he has to transfer from one atmosphere into the other, and that creates decompression problems with medical, attendant medical problems, how to prevent the bends, this kind of thing. Now, if we tell the Russians, why don't you also put pure oxygen into your spacecraft, they may say this creates a fire hazard for some of our electrical equipment for which we haven't designed things. And if they tell us, why don't you go to air full pressure, then we have a pressure problem in our command module. So there are some technical difficulties, but I can assure you these problems can be solved, and we are all very glad in NASA to hear that finally the political stumbling blocks seem to have been removed and we are really talking nuts and bolts with the Soviets. I'm quite confident that this will lead to success. Next slide, please. To give you an idea of what the accommodations will be like inside this spacecraft, into this space, in the space station, here's a typical stateroom accommodation inside this Skylab. So you see, this is quite a departure from the inconvenience and the crowded conditions in the Apollo command module. I would like to point out that these crew accommodations have some real interesting and partly even tricky aspects. And no problem turned out to be more elusive than the problem of the hygienic facilities, which of course have to operate under zero gravity. Let me leave it at that. Next slide, please. This chart attempts to depict some of the typical activities that we plan for the Skylab. The Skylab will first, by the first three astronauts, be visited for a period of 28 days, or about a month. Now, this is already a time substantially longer than the 18 days that two cosmonauts, Nikolayev and Zevastyanov, stayed in orbit. We go from there 18 days to 28 days. But I talked to Nikolayev and Houston last week, and he told me he had absolutely no doubts that 28 days won't be a problem. He just believed that the guys wouldn't walk as proudly off their spacecraft as they were used to, because you get a little wobbly in the knees, like if you had been laid up in bed as a hospital patient for an extended period of time. But other than that, he didn't expect major difficulties. There will be scientific experiments in Skylabs in the area of geophysics, upper atmosphere physics, interplanetary medium physics. I mentioned already solar astronomy using this Apollo telescope mount. And finally, galactic and intergalactic astronomy using this fabulous platform of observation above the atmosphere to study the universe. And there will be biomedical studies, effects of long-duration spaceflight on man's functions, nutrition, musculoskeletal, cardiovascular, hematology, immunology, neurophysiology, pulmonary, and finally body metabolism. In other words, the famous energy balance, what goes in, what goes out, and how much effort does a man exert, for example, running the little bicycle here while his oxygen consumption is metered, etc. Then we have quite a program in technology, how to process materials. There will be an expandable airlock, studies in zero-G, flammability, thermal control, coatings, radiation, crew vehicle disturbances. But this will only be a beginning of what we think is a very exciting new field, namely to use the zero-G environment to manufacture things that you just can't manufacture in the normal gravitational field. I can't go into very much detail here, but let me just say this. Wood is a very typical example how one and the same chemical, namely cellulose, can appear in quite a spectrum of densities, all the way from very light balsa wood or cork to very heavy oak wood that hardly floats in water. The difference is, of course, the packing density of the cellulose molecules. When we talk about steel, however, or aluminum, we always talk about the same specific weight of the material. Steel just has a certain weight, so many ounces per cubic inch, and that's it. Well, not in zero gravity. For example, if you put some steel pellets together and mix them up with an ingredient that creates gas bubbles, and you heat it up, melt it, until the gas bubbles, until the organic material produces enough gas bubbles so that your steel melt goes up like a foam. And then you freeze it down, you have created a steel foam whose density solely depends on the ratio of steel particles, or iron particles for that matter, and gas particles. Just by providing the proper initial mix between the little steel pellets and the organic gas-producing pellets, you can make a steel of any kind of specific weight you want. For example, you can make a solid steam foil that a foam that floats in water. And this is only one example. You can make alloys of material of very, very different density, because you no longer have to fight the problem in zero gravity that your bubbles or the lighter material rise to the top. Everything stays where it is. You just heat it up. The melting mixes the ingredients, and then you gel it down and you have any alloy you want. So you can tremendously widen the spectrum of materials. Now, of course, you will say, well, who wants to do all this processing in outer space at today's transportation cost? Well, this is one of the reasons why we have to bring these costs down. And, of course, just like air transportation for cargo was not very interesting as long as prices were very high, it becomes more and more attractive for even mundane things as the price of air cargo transportation goes down. And so it will be with space. Now, we will never propose to build bridge girders in outer space, but when it comes to some sophisticated electronic materials, for instance, or pharmaceutical products like pills, this kind of a thing, space with its unique zero gravity environment to manufacture may be the place to go. Just another example to show the possibilities. You know, you all know how to blow a soap bubble. Well, in outer space and zero gravity, you can make a soap bubble out of liquid steel. And if you gel it, after it has blown to a certain dimension, you have the most accurate, thin-walled, hollow sphere you can imagine. You can never make a thing like that on Earth in gravity, because gravity would deform it. And so it goes. There are thousands of possibilities that industry finds awfully exciting. Well, a fourth activity in Skylab will be crew operations designed to improve methods of crew performance. For example, as shown here, an astronaut maneuvering unit, extravehicular hardware evaluation for floating around outside the spacecraft, a gravity substitute workbench, how to hold a piece of paper, for example, on the table with a little vacuum underneath. These kind of mundane but important things to make crew operations in zero gravity effective. Chart, please. I mentioned our solar observatory. This observatory will actually accommodate 6 major experiments. A white light coronagraph, a coronal spectroheliograph, a chromospheric spectrograph, an X-ray spectrographic telescope, an H-alpha telescope, and high-resolution X-ray telescopes. Now, these are long words here. The message is, we know very little about the sun, and yet the sun is the life-giving source for everything on Earth. If somebody would turn the sun off, life would discontinue, would disappear on Earth within a matter of a few days. And yet, all we know about the sun so far is really what we have learned through the atmosphere. Now, my good friend Fred Whipple, who runs the Smithsonian Observatory right here at Harvard, once put it this way. He said, all we know about the universe is what we have learned through the dirty basement window of the atmosphere. It's very true. The atmosphere is only transparent for visible light, a tiny little bit of infrared, a very little bit of ultraviolet, and then there's a radio window through which we can talk to our astronauts in the longer wavelengths regime. It's very true. The atmosphere is only transparent for visible light, a tiny little bit of infrared, a very little bit of ultraviolet, and then there's a radio window through which we could talk to our astronauts in the longer wavelengths regime. But that's all. Compare that with the vast electromagnetic spectrum ranging all the way from gamma rays on the very short wave length end to the many mile long low frequency waves that are emitted by some of the stars. and you know and you can see how much we can learn about the universe if we really develop a program studying and observing the universe in the light of this entire electromagnetic spectrum. This we cannot do, and fundamentally not do, from the bottom of the atmospheric shell. We have to go above the atmosphere. There and only there is that spectrum available. Now there's another payoff. In our atmosphere there's a lot of turbulence, and all you have to do is look at the stars through a high magnifying glass, and you see what I mean. The mountains and the moon dance around. When you are in a you look through a telescope above the atmosphere, this problem simply does not exist. You get the radiation unhampered by any medium between the emitting heavenly body and the telescope. So it is not very surprising then that our Apollo telescope for solar astronomy that we put at the Skylab emphasizes that part of the spectrum for which the atmosphere is opaque, with the only exception maybe of the white light coronagraph. Now the corona of the sun is of course this huge cloud of plasma gas surrounding the sun, possibly up to the diameter of the Earth orbit. And the reason why we do that from outer space is that we cannot measure the extent of the corona beyond a certain dimness because of the so-called air glow in our own atmosphere. We hope to be able to get several orders of magnitude and sensitivity further down by really surveying the size of the corona, even in white light, for which the atmosphere is transparent, by observation from orbit. But all the other things are in X-ray, in H-alpha, this is the alpha line of the hydrogen atom, in the ultraviolet, and X-ray telescopes to study, for example, the X-ray radiation emanating from solar spots and from other solar surface activities, while simultaneously, of course, photographing them in visible light. From all these things, scientists hope to learn more about the sun, and this will undoubtedly help us a great deal understanding the energy transfer mechanism from the sun to the Earth better. And this energy transfer mechanism, of course, is what affects our weather, what affects the ecology of our atmosphere, all these things. Next slide. On this chart, you see the six, I think only five are listed here, major experimentors that have their experiments on this Apollo telescope mount. There's Dr. Newkirk of the High Altitude Observatory in Boulder, Colorado, with his white light coronagraph. There's Dr. Purcell of the Naval Research Laboratory with his spectroheliograph and chromospheric spectrograph. And Dr. Giacconi, who runs the American Science and Engineering Company and has pioneered a new X-ray spectrographic telescope, which we all think is a very exciting new instrument. Then there's, of course, Leo Goldberg here from the Harvard College Observatory with his UV scanning polychromator and spectroheliometer. UV scanning polychromator and spectroheliometer. Okay. And Mr. Milligan of the Goddard Space Flight Center, this high resolution X-ray telescope. Next slide, please. This gives you an idea of the real dimensions of this thing. Here's the Apollo telescope mount. These are the covers of the six instruments. And here you see an astronaut floating up in zero gravity to this position to extract film cassettes from the business end of these various special telescopes. You see, there's a rather informal arrangement here. You just open the door and float out and get these things out and bring them back. And these are the power supply solar cells for the instrumentation inside. Would like to point out that one very major engineering requirement for this telescope is, of course, that it is precisely stabilized and bracketed to the sun. And this instrument here has a capability of doing this with an accuracy of 1 second of arc. This is already in the order, not quite as good, but in the order of what the Palomar telescope does with all its terrific foundations on the ground. We are presently trying to build a new telescope, a next generation type stellar telescope, where this pointing accuracy would be 0.1 second of arc, 1/10 of a second of arc. Now, a second of arc is 1 over 3,600 of a degree. So this is a terrific accuracy. Next slide, please. This is one of the biomedical experiments. This particular experiment, number 171, is for metabolic activity. I think you get the idea here. This guy pedals a machine in the space station. He can apply a certain load that he wants. Actually, what he does is this. He is told, we want to get your heartbeat up, say, to 140. And now you dial a load here on your pedals until your heartbeat is 120. And keep pedaling at that speed. And then at that speed, we measure what your oxygen intake is, and we measure your heartbeat, and there are all these various probes all over his body that give us an idea of what really happens within the guy. Let me make a little side remark on medical instrumentation in this context. You have read a great deal about spin-off products of the space age, and I believe that these medical instruments that were developed for the astronauts to monitor their performance in orbit are among the most important contributions we have made. We have recently, with the help of this instrumentation, built an experimental hospital in Alabama, which works on the following principle. We have said, let's assume this hospital has 500 patients in 500 private rooms and only one nurse. And all patients in this hospital must be continuously monitored as though they were in intensive care treatment, so that nothing must be overlooked, not even for a second. If any clinical reading develops in any of these 500 patients, the nurse must be alerted immediately. So the 500 patients are equipped with paste on monitors for things like heartbeat or pulse rate, if you will, breathing cycle, skin temperature, body temperature, skin humidity, and even encephalographic brain emissions, which means the electromagnetic waves emanating from your skull while you are thinking or sleeping. And all this information reduces the respective data to electrical information. And this electrical information is then fed into a computer. And the computer is preset in such a way that it knows, its memory knows, what is tolerable for a person. For instance, if your normal body temperature is 98.2, the computer is told you don't worry about the patient as long as it's between 99 and 97.5. But if it gets above or below this, out of the permissible threshold, you alert the nurse. And there will be a bell ringing in the nurse's room, and a little printout comes out of the computer which says, patient in room 273 has plus 2 degrees temperature. And then the nurse knows exactly what to do. Now, we are told that this is a terrific thing for hospitals to have, because you can really do a much better job and give a lot more attention to people who need continuous monitoring and intensive care. And this is a clear spin-off product of the space age. Well, I don't want to read all these words to you again. You see that there is quite a biological program, and we really would like to understand how people react to long-term neurogravity. Next slide, please. This chart is a little complicated. It shows here also the various objectives. These are the various experiment numbers, and explains the interrelationship between these various experiments. The human body, of course, is one system, and whatever you pick up, say, with a cardiovascular measurement here, may have some effect on the central nervous system status, etc. So there's a logical interrelationship. Let's try to pinpoint it here. One of the interesting questions, by the way, in this connection is the circadian rhythm. This is, of course, the same problem that you all know when you fly from here to the West Coast and suddenly you are 3 hours off in your time standard and you can't go to bed when you should, or you get hungry in the middle of the night, or sleep in a meeting, or as the case may be. And it takes you several days to get your body clock, your metabolic clock, tuned into the Californian condition, for instance. Next slide. I mentioned material processing in space. This is a piece of equipment that we will use inside the Skylab to do this thing. Essentially, you have a vacuum chamber here with a viewport, power connections, where all these kind of things can be done. I mentioned composite casting, spherical casting, electron beam welding is another very interesting thing. And here, single crystal growing is something that some people are very excited about. Some people believe that the limit to which you can grow a crystal is set by gravitational disturbances, and maybe in zero gravity will one finally learn to grow diamonds that are that big. Maybe we'll learn to finance the space program from them. Next slide. Now, probably the most important thing we propose to do with Skylab is to take a major hack at this problem of Earth survey operations. And this chart attempts to depict what we are trying to do here. Remember that a satellite, whether it's a Skylab or a little one, goes around the Earth in an orbit in approximately one revolution in 90 minutes. And if it's properly oriented, you can make it look down onto the Earth all the time, as shown here. And if it is equipped with suitable optical equipment, you can, for instance, view a swath, like in this case, 48 miles wide, or a wider swath, 80 miles wide, or even make some measurements on a still wider swath, like the blue ones, 320 nautical miles wide. It's just the question, what kind of field of view you want to cover. Now, with observation, you need not limit this observation to normal photography. You can do this information gathering in the light of infrared. You can use spectrometers. And you can use all kinds of sophisticated techniques to get more information out than just out of photography. And this is what I'd like to talk a little more about in subsequent charts. Next slide, please. Being placed into a 50-degree inclination orbit, which means that the northernmost point of the orbit is at 50-degree latitude, the equator, of course, being zero and the pole being 90 degrees, this yellow area shows the degree of coverage of the planet Earth from that orbit. And you see that all of the United States, with the exclusion of Alaska, is covered by such an orbit. Practically all of Latin America is covered, all of Africa is covered. The southern portion of Central Europe is covered. In the Soviet Union, those parts of Siberia, for instance, that are not in permafrost are covered. So a very major portion of the globe can be continuously observed this way. We can, of course, in theory, go into a polar orbit and cover everything, but there are good reasons to limit the early experiment to 50 degrees, and this has been chosen. As flown from Cape Kennedy, this, of course, means that our space station launched from here, Cape Kennedy, has to go out on this kind of a heading as it is injected into orbit. The Earth continuously rotates at the rate of one revolution in 24 hours, within the space-fixed orbit. As a result, this swath of land overflown that you saw in the previous picture is slowly moving to the west as the Earth rotates within the orbit. And within one day, practically every point on Earth comes in view. Now, allowing for the fact, of course, that part of the Earth would be at night, you can say within 2 days at least, you have an opportunity to view every point on Earth under good observation conditions. Next slide, please. Now, this first picture here of an agricultural and forestry project taken from an orbital, with an orbital camera is shown here. What you're looking at here is the Salton Sea in California, photographed in infrared. And this area here underneath is an area irrigated by a river that flows into this Salton Sea. Now, this is photographed in infrared, but in what we call false colors. For example, what you see here in red is predominantly alfalfa. To some extent, it is, I think, corn. And the greener or grayer portions are orchards. The important thing to remember on this photograph is here the degree of distinction, how you can really see individual field patches in different colors. One other interesting detail that I'd like to bring to your attention is this. You will note that at this point, the coloration of the picture suddenly ceases and everything is gray. This is the border between the United States and Mexico. And it simply says, below here, people don't buy fertilizer. And they don't have good irrigation ditches to provide an adequate irrigation system for these fields. There's still some vegetation here. It is not desert land, but it clearly doesn't produce very thing. Now, this is the key to the understanding of what spaceflight can do for agriculture and forestry. We can find out what is being grown and how is the vigor of the crop. What crop can we expect to harvest? Next slide, please. Now, here you see this in a little more detail. This is actually from the same chart. Pinal Valley, Salton Sea again. And what you can use this information for? Land use planning, crop irrigation, regional development, crop yield, grazing range management. Here's again the American-Mexican border. Next slide. Now, this picture shows the same area photographed from a high-altitude aircraft. You just see that the magnification has been vastly increased here. You see the individual roads now, houses, and so forth. And on the next picture, you see the same area photographed from a low-altitude aircraft. I'm just showing you this to remind you that simply by greater magnification, by a more powerful optical system in the orbital spacecraft, you can also go to this magnification. In other words, whether you fly at 3,000 feet altitude, like this picture was taken, with a not very powerful optical system, or you go into to 200 miles up in orbit, you can have this kind of resolution if you want it. But as a matter of fact, you don't want it. You want rather larger area coverage. You are not interested, for instance, looking at individual plants or the fact that around here the crop vigor in this field may not be as high as it is on here or here. But you would like to know, for planning purposes, how much corn can we expect to harvest from this entire field. Next slide, please. Now, here you see, just to illustrate the method used here, an aerial photograph taken of a timber area in Oregon. What you see here are individual trees. There's a river flowing through here. And these trees are also photographed in what we call false color, in infrared. These trees are infected by insects, partly. And the damaged trees, the ones infected by these damaging insects, appear blue or blue-green. The healthy trees appear red or pink. Now, just imagine you had a walk through this forest and point out which trees are sick. Well, all you see is the trunk, of course, of the tree. What is sick is the leaves way up there. You would have a very hard time even saying which trees ought to be treated or chopped down, as the case may be. With one such photograph, you get the whole picture. And this technique can to the widest possible extent, be used for crop prediction and forest surveys and the like. Now, in Canada, for instance, every year, $200 million or so of timber is irretrievably lost as a result of insect infestation and fungus infestation, where the local people simply can't do a thing about it because they can't even identify the areas that have already been affected, so they can't direct, say, spraying airplanes out there to stop this cancer from growing into still unaffected neighboring areas. Next slide, please. Now, this chart here tries to explain the fundamental technique of Earth resources surveys going beyond this rather primitive false color photographing that I just pointed out. Suppose you take four cameras and equip one camera with a color film particularly sensitive in the red band of the visible spectrum, one particularly sensitive in infrared, one in near-infrared, and one in the green band of the spectrum, and photograph the same area. And you see the differences. There are some features that you can easily recognize, like this tongue of desert here, but other areas, you can also identify this here, but other areas look quite different. For example, this here looks very light-shaded in near-infrared and quite colorful here in the deeper infrared. In the red band, it looks dark, and the green band, it looks gray. Now, by running a slide like this through a photometer and scan it with a scanning photometer, which continuously measures the intensity of the gray, the shade of gray at each point on this picture, and by putting this in a digitizer and make a printout of the area, you can get a very clear signature or a map of what this area contains, how much energy it contains in the red band and the near IR and the green band, etc. And it is these differences, how a certain area shows in the various bands of the spectrum, that enable us to identify very amazing details with respect to the nature of the crop. We are now in a position not only to say this field is rye and this is barley and this is wheat and this is corn and this is soybean, but we can even say this is soybeans growing on light soil, under-fertilized, and if you added a little nitrogen fertilizer to that particular soybean, you could probably double your crop expectation. We can get this kind of definition not solely by scientific analysis of the data, but simply by calibration. We build calibration patches on the ground and overfly them with these kind of sensors and simply measure what kind of signature, what kind of differences in intensity we measure in the various parts of the spectrum. And since we know what we have on the ground, since we know the ground truth, we can simply have a dictionary and say if the shade of gray and red is 34 out of possible 48 shades of gray all the way from black to white, and if it's 22 in the IR, and if it's 16 in the green band and so forth, that means very clearly and unmistakably hybrid corn that needs a little water, for instance. Of course, all this information would be meaningless and it would virtually drown us with data had it not been for these high-speed digital computers that enable us to print out maps with all this information where the information is directly readable out of the map printed by this thing. Next slide, please. Oh, here's one more chart explaining the principle of multispectral experimentation. We have, of course, two possible technological solutions for this. Either we use a single camera and have a three-layer emulsion color film, for example, a red, a blue, and a green sensitive film, the three layers of emulsion, and we get this kind of picture. But we can also use three cameras. Put a green sensitive film in one, a red sensitive in another, and an IR sensitive in a third one, make three independent pictures, and then have a projection printer that puts these pictures one on top of the other and the result of that picture. The message of this slide here is that this technique is far more powerful than this one, as you can see from the results. Now let me say one more thing. In the real world, we will not even want and need multispectral cameras to do this. We don't want to fly 6 or 12 bore-sided cameras and loading up a lot of color film with this, as much as Eastman Kodak may like that. We will not even use photographic techniques in themselves at all in the future. The multispectral scanner will simply consist of a very powerful lens and a little rocking mirror that goes along as we fly through the orbit. And it will continuously scan the ground underneath. And the light that comes out of this thing will go into a prism where it will be split into the spectrum. And at the end of the spectrum will be 6 sensors writing down continuously the amount of electrical current flowing out of these 6 sensors. And we can now see at any given point when the mirror was in this position, we were looking at that particular plot of land, and the green, the shade of gray in the green, at that point, the readout from that particular photocell was, say, 34 shades of gray, as digitized by the digitizer attached to it, and is printed as such directly into the map. So this satellite goes around the orbit and produces continuously maps that see what is being grown and how is it coming along, and also what could you do in order to improve the crop in that particular area.